The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hi, Dr. Ray. How are you?
I'm sure I'm going to get really good advice from you.
Why do I have to be the insightful professional?
You just patted yourself on the back.
I'm losing you, buddy. I don't know what you're trying to say.
You're just so great. I love your show.
Am I close?
No.
Does that comfort you?
No.
I'm sorry, and I'm going to confess it, because I'm a holy guy.
I'm a little intimidated to talk to you because you used a lot of big words.
You know, I was looking for a deeper answer.
You came to the wrong place. You came to the wrong place if you're looking for deep answers.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Good to have you with me. Sometimes this is, well, first of all, I better introduce the program. Let's look back Friday, where we take a look at previous callers. We really can't see them, but take a listen to previous callers, and then we extrapolate, go a little further on the call. Now, something that's not really possible to do when the call first comes in, because usually we have a number of folks on the line who want to talk, and I get accused sometimes of not getting through the calls quick enough, but I want to give folks a little bit of time. Sometimes then I just take those calls, bring them to a future look back show, and then I get to talk more about them because they bring up something that could be addressed, or there's a direction that I would have wanted to go, but they didn't want to go that way. You can go 50 different directions in any given call, and it's not therapy. So as a result, Look Back Friday fits the bill a little bit. So we'll get to some of these calls in a moment. Some years ago, at a presentation, I asked a group of parents, how many of you are getting the help around the house that you would like? I forget how many parents there were there, 100 maybe. Two of them raised their hand. They were immediately yelled at. Liar! Liars! By the other 98. I asked then, for those of you who aren't getting the help, if not, why not? Survey says, too busy. Kids are into many, many things. It's easier for me just to do it myself. With the nagging and the dragging uphill and the reminding and the poor jobs that they do the first three times through, it's just easier for me to do it myself. And then the third one was, we really don't have that much for them to do. We don't live on a farm in 1880 where they got to get up at 4 o'clock, go milk the cows before they throw wood into the burner. This raises the question, why do so many parents, it's universal really, do so many parents feel like they don't get willingly the chore help that they would like to get from the kids? Some parents will say, well, if I ask, if I push, if I have a requirement, they'll do it. But not too many will say the child comes up and volunteers. Mom, let me do the dishes for you. Mom, let me sweep. Let me sweep the family room. Hey, Dad, you mow the front, I'll mow the back. That typically doesn't happen. Now, why is this? Many of you listening have, quote unquote, good kids. You look at your kids, everybody likes them, everybody admires them. From a moral perspective, they're different than their peer group. Why would this be? Why in the arena of chores and household help are kids so slow? I have my theories. One of them is related to the fact that we have pretty much eliminated for our children the kinds of things that in human history people had to do to stay alive. They had to grow their own food, or they had to shoot meat, or they had to build. They had to make things that were necessary. This is most of human history. And it is in many cultures today, in undeveloped countries, underdeveloped countries. It's the way it is. But in our country, Western culture, for the most part, not much is asked of the kids. Oh, they may have a few chores here and there. Take the trash down on Tuesdays. Load the dishwasher. Make your bed. A few very brief kinds of requirements, but nothing that is intrusive all that much in their day-to-day existence. For the most part, their day-to-day existence is, if you take away school, it's pretty entertaining. It's pretty comfortable. They can get on all kinds of media, play video games. They have after-school activities, sports. Their time awake is occupied by a certain amount of self-satisfaction. The idea of spending an hour, for example, of a day, even a Saturday, on helping around the house is pretty much foreign. Yeah, I have talked to parents who say that, yeah, Saturday morning is house cleaning day, and we and the kids, we do what we got to do, and they all have their chores, and we have our chores. I've heard that, but it is not common. Not common at all. Furthermore, when the parents ask the kid, sometimes they're very frustrated because the child either puts it off or argues. Why do I have to do it? He didn't have to do it. Why should I have to do that? He made the mess. Or the child is washing something and they've left their stuff sitting all over the table. They didn't even put it in the sink. And you call them and it looks like you've just awakened a hibernating grizzly. They kind of stomp in, like, how intrusive. I am not demeaning our children. I'm not trying to be a grandparent who says, you know, in my day, we didn't do that. I'm not doing that. I'm just observing the reality, even among my own children who are grown now. And I find, now let me extrapolate here. Let me go a step further on this. Those of you who have young adult children, perhaps living on their own, have you noticed their cars are kind of a shambles? You get into their car, it's like, ho, when's the last time this thing even saw a vacuum? What is all that stuff on the floor? Look at this car. That's one. Two, you go to their place. When was the last time somebody went through here and picked it up? So that, what I call chore interruption in their day-to-day pleasurable existence, continues. It continues into adulthood for many, if not most. How do you break that cycle? Well, the bad news is it's hard. Because according to one of the rationales that parents gave for not getting the help around the house, there's just not much to do. And that is true. By and large, we have an awful lot of conveniences that take over the drudgery of what used to be living. So that's the first thing. That's the bad news. The good news is there's a lot of room for us to ask, perhaps demand, more help from our children. I always tell moms of teenagers, your days of domestic labor should really be coming to a close. It should be reduced. You're doing your kids a favor by requiring all this because they're going to be on their own. And maybe someday they're going to marry somebody and you don't want their spouse to think, my gosh, I can't. This bathroom is trashed every time he or she uses it. Constantly picking up after them. You don't want that. Now, if you do come up with a whole lot of things for them to do, that doesn't mean that they're going to be taking care of their things. This is something, by the way, not to focus on teenagers or young adults, but it is something that you can look at even among older adults. Drive down the street, take a visual survey inside garages. All the stuff that is in there, kind of just helter-skelter in there. Some of the stuff's been in there for months and years of no use, but it's still in there. I personally think the two factors heavily involved in this is, one, our kids' lives, by and large, are very pleasurable. They're very entertainment-filled. And the things of chores and responsibility are slipping off the pyramid. They really are. There isn't a whole lot for them to have to do. And so this is an intrusion. It is something that, in their mind, shouldn't be part of their day-to-day existence. That's a factor. The other factor is too much stuff. Go into a kid's room, and you look at it, and you think, oh, man, there's got to be animals in here. There's got to be Japanese soldiers from World War II that didn't know the war's over yet. Why is this? Well, look at the possessions. How many pairs of shoes are scattered every which way? How many pieces of clothing are just sort of all over the place? They have so much of so much that there's the simple inverse rule. The more I have, the less I take care of it. I mean, that's as simple as it is. If your 7-year-old daughter had one doll, do you think she'd be more or less likely to take care of that doll than if she had 9? So, bottom line advice. Come up with stuff. Find stuff for the kids to do. And don't get into arguments with them. Make those chores linked to everything they ask for. Hey, Mom, I'm heading out. You mind? I'll be back around 9. Oh, wait a minute. Is your room clean yet? Hey, Mom, where's that one DVD I want to watch? Yeah, I need you to sweep out the garage first. Sure. Many of you have very able-bodied teenagers. Go for it. Help them out to help you out. All right. When we come back, I'm going to see what we got up there. Amanda has a question about feelings and emotions. Now, most people think those are the same thing. But from perhaps a psychological perspective, there's nuanced differences. I'm Dr. Ray.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?
This is Dr. Ray Guarendi.
I think you're just absolutely wonderful.
The doctor will be with you in just a moment.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. For decades after Christ's resurrection, the gospel stories were circulated only by word of mouth. How is it possible that the gospel records were transmitted without error before being written down? The answers are intriguing. For one thing, in ancient Judaism, memories were perfected by endless repetition, patterned learning, and mnemonics, and it helped that the culture demanded complete recall. Further, the gospel stories were protected by the oversight of living eyewitnesses and the ever-present opposition in the crowds who were anxious to correct any misreporting. Finally, the reporting of embarrassing events about the authors themselves tells us that they were more interested in telling the truth than covering up. And all that is evidence for Christianity. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Get more information on today's guest and download the program from the Ave Maria Radio website, AveMariaRadio.net. And when your local radio signal is out of reach, listen live on the Ave Maria Radio app.
Support for Ave Maria programming comes in part by CatholicCounselors.com. Self-help resources and support from Catholic telecounselors from the privacy of home. CatholicCounselors.com, helping your faith, life, and relationships flourish.
Piggybacking on that opening monologue, my producer man, Andrew Krucek, made the observation that even among his little children, they wear it for a little bit and they throw it in a hamper. And I saw that with my own children. And I suspect some of you deal with this, which is, yeah, I wore it one day. It's not dirty. It's not smelly, but I'm just going to throw it in a hamper. Why? My theory? Easier to do that than to hang it up. Just throw it in there. Get another one. Okay. Let's go to Amanda from Ohio. Let's see what she's asking about feelings and emotions. What do you mean by saying, I'm doing the right thing, but I don't have comfort in it?
Well, okay, so it's not me. It's from a friend I was talking to the other day. Her situation was she's taken in a couple of kids. She and her husband have custody of them from a bad situation. And one of them was older. She was 9 when they got her. And she's just been a really difficult kid for them to try and bring into their stable life.
Wait a minute. She wasn't prepared that this was going to happen? She naively thought?
I don't know. But she's trying to give all this love and good discipline and affection and just a good family life to this girl, and she's saying that she feels like she's lying because her emotions for the affection, I think, for the kid aren't always there because she's such a difficult child. So I don't know why it would feel like a lie. I tried to tell her, you're doing what you should be doing, but she felt like she was lying.
Jeez, I remember reading a story about a fella who knew he had to do the right thing, but temporarily it so distressed him that he sweated droplets of blood. I remember that. Where did I read that story?
That's good.
I'll have to look that up, okay? But I do remember that. I think your friend is operating at two levels. The first level is, if you do something that is good and right, you should have universally good feelings about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you how many times I forced myself to do the right thing because I didn't want to. First of all, that's the human condition. The Lord loves a cheerful giver. Yeah, that's ideal. But if you can't be cheerful about it, give anyway, because that's what you're supposed to do. Gee, I don't know if I want to write out a $100 check to that charity. I really don't want to do that, but it's the right thing to do. I'm going to do it. So your friend, I think, is thinking that if she's doing a good thing, then she should have peace and comfort in doing it. Not necessarily. The second level, she's doing a good thing with another human being in the equation. And that other human being isn't making it easy to do this good thing. And furthermore, your friend understandably doesn't always have warm feelings towards this little girl because she's difficult. She's problematic. The poor thing has had junk for an upbringing. That's why your friend had to step in.
Right.
And so as a result, this kid ain't easy to like. But here's what you tell your friend. You tell your friend, you love this child more than you know. And the reason is because you've committed yourself to her. That love, the commitment, the emotions, the feeling, all of that is secondary.
Okay.
The commitment is the love. When we adopted our twins, they were 4 years of age when we adopted them. Now, at that point, we had other kids, 6, 5, 3, and 1. We adopted the twins. They had very little in the way of consistent upbringing prior to that. So when they came into our home,
they really threw it for a loop. They were difficult. They were unpleasant. They had all kinds of behavior problems. And it was very hard to relate to them initially. Very hard. Still, we knew we were doing the right thing. As a result, we did what we could to love them, to discipline them, even though it was easier to feel warmth towards the other kids. It was easier.
Yeah.
The kids were easier to feel warmth towards. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell your friend, one, just because you're doing the right thing doesn't mean you're going to be all fluffy about it and feeling good emotionally. Two, she's making a commitment to this little girl, which is powerful love. That's powerful love. And three, she may have to, over time, do a lot more faking it and forcing herself to act with affection and care. Tell her not to worry about what the feeling is down deep. Just okay. Do the right thing by this little girl. I believe it was in C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. He made the observation that if a stray cat was on the road in trouble, it would be much easier for a cat lover to show love, to feel warmth and good about picking up that cat. Someone who is terrified of cats, someone who doesn't want to be near one, much less touch one, to pick up that wounded cat would make them quite distressed. But it is the far stronger act of love. They had to go against their feelings. That's what's happening here with Amanda's friend. She's rather shell-shocked that this kid is hard to like. She didn't expect that. She just thought, okay, this child needs love. She needs a stable home. She needs parents who are predictable. And we're going to get her out of that wretched environment she was in, and she will blossom. And when she didn't, the feelings of disappointment mixed with failure, mixed with what did I do with my life, all kind of worked together, percolating in a cauldron. And she found something about herself. This is distressing, too. She found that maybe I'm not the loving person I thought I was. I thought I was capable of so much warmth and affection. And I really am struggling to give it to this child. I get nothing back. And what I do get back is ugly. If she tells herself that her love is manifested in her perseverance for this kid, and that she can't expect to have warm feelings all the time, maybe it's just a little bit of the time when the kid's asleep and she looks at her and says, hey, doesn't she look angelic when she's asleep? So given that, she's doing something that so many people do in our culture now, which is equate their feelings with authenticity. If I feel a certain way, then I'm being genuine in what I do. If I don't feel a certain way, then I'm not being genuine. I'm acting counter to my deepest desires. The Christian acts counter to their desires all the time. If that were the case, difficult kids would never be adopted. Because there will be many moments where the feelings are not what you wanted them to be. Nevertheless, you did what was good.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I often go back to my childhood. In church, we love to be reverent, to Christ present in the Eucharist, to Christ on the cross. But I was also impressed by the reverence of my friends in the Salvation Army. They had a little band, and I used to walk past the band on Sunday morning on my way to church. And I was just a child, but I said, you know, they're trying to pray to God. They're showing reverence to God. All this was reverence. Now what do I see? I hear one irreverence after another. And week after week, month after month, the media churns out things that make fun of religion in general and make fun of Christianity in particular, and particularly make fun of the Catholic Church. No class. Absolutely no class.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What sins should Catholics mention in confession? According to the Catechism, we are obliged to confess serious sin at least once a year. A mortal sin must be confessed and sacramental absolution received before taking communion, unless there is a very grave reason for receiving communion and there is no possibility of going to confession. Confessing all the sins a penitent can remember undoubtedly places him or her before the divine mercy for pardon. If, however, a penitent knowingly withholds sins, he places nothing before the divine goodness for remission through the priest. Confessing venial sins is not strictly necessary, but is strongly urged by the Church in order to fight evil tendencies, to strengthen our conscience, and let ourselves be healed by Christ. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism. Thank you for listening.
A little piece of, well, microscopic life advice. Never trust an atom. They make up everything. Okay, this is Look Back Friday on The Doctor Is In, and I thank you for joining me here. 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. I don't know exactly what our time schedule is in the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean, maybe the deepest part of the ocean, like 7 miles down. But we're there. You can probably pick us up. I don't know if you get full cell reception. You probably wouldn't want to take your cell out of the bathysphere, because if you did, it would be immediately crushed. The water pressure down there is beyond comprehension. Jamie from Kansas has someone who just refuses forgiveness, towards Jamie anyway. You've apologized to somebody and they threw it back in your face.
Yeah, said they will never forgive me. There was a group of people talking about this person. It got back to them what was said, and I was one of those people, and I apologized and was just go on from that. If you have to see this person all the time. It was just some simple gossip, which obviously is wrong, but how do you deal with that then?
You kind of got pulled along in with the boo birds, huh?
Right.
Everybody was kind of jumping on the gossip bandwagon, and you figure, yeah, I know her. She's that way too. Yeah, you made a mistake. We all do it. I mean, that's got to be one of the most common sins we do, where we get swept along with kind of trashing somebody. You've gone and apologized. And this person's reaction was what?
Just simply, okay, but I'll never forgive you. Or I will forgive you, I'll never be your friend again, we can never be friends again.
That's kind of a, that's I don't want to say it's an oxymoron, that's just a contradiction here. I forgive you, but get out of my life.
Yes.
Well, I think you can safely assume in their mind they're not forgiving you. You know, you could be really, really junky. You could, in the words of Beaver Cleaver, you could be really junky about this, and you could say to this person, well, you know, with given that attitude, I probably wasn't all that wrong when I was talking about you then. No, don't say that. Don't say that. It's a horrible temptation to have the ability to do something, to say something like that, and have to stifle myself. So, Jamie, you did the right thing. You did the right thing. You do what you're supposed to do. And sometimes it just don't work. Don't ever judge the rightness of what you do by its results. What you did was right. Didn't work out. Matter of fact, you right. could make the case that it made it worse, you know?
Yeah.
You went to this person with your hat in your hand and said, "I'm so sorry, I got carried away, it was foolish." And she probably, or he probably said, "Well, I know what you think of me now, so if you think of me like that." I guess the only thing you could probably say if you want to try to salvage the friendship is to go back and say, "I don't think those things. I was foolish. I got pulled along in this conversation where I shouldn't have. I don't think that." Maybe that'll soften this person up. But if it doesn't, well, do you ever see the movie The Natural with Roy Hobbs?
No.
There's a line in The Natural where Hobbs says, "Some mistakes you never stop paying for." Well, you made a mistake, and the results seem to be long-term here. But you did what was right. You can be at peace for saying, "Out of weakness, I really did bad. But I tried to make it right, and the other person said, get lost."
Yeah.
You know? And it may be the other person doesn't follow any kind of Christian morality. Why? If they don't, then they don't have to forgive you, right? It's all just purely preference now.
Yeah.
So, there you go, Jamie. This is wild speculation on my part. I don't know. But based upon experiences like this across people, seeing him in counseling and that, when someone says, "I forgive you, but I will never again have anything to do with you," you can probably assume this is a fragile person. This is someone who is so, so offended by anyone saying or thinking negatively of them that they just can't handle it. They don't have enough emotional sturdiness to say, "Yeah, okay, yeah, she probably shouldn't have said it." Or better, "Well, I guess I do come across that way sometimes, don't I?" That takes a ton of self-confidence and emotional sturdiness. And you know what else it takes? It takes humility. So for someone to say, "How dare you say that about me? How dare you think I'm like that? I cannot ever again relate to you." I don't know exactly what Jamie said. I got to believe it's not life-shattering. Somebody say, "Dr. Ray, you don't know what she said. She could have said something very, 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 very terrible." There was no indication of that. Jamie didn't confess and say, "What I said was so horrible and awful, I understand why they reacted that way." No, it sounds like just a bunch of people picking on a personality trait or something. And for this person to react that way means they cannot handle or tolerate anybody thinking negatively of them. I find it fascinating, too, was Jamie the only one to go apologize? What about the other people? There's a group of them. I personally think if I were in the other person's shoes and Jamie came and apologized to me, it's like Jesus said, did I not cure 12? Where's the other 11? The one leper that came back to thank Jesus. Jamie went and said, Jamie didn't have to do that. This other person probably wouldn't have known about it, but she felt obliged by her conscience to say, "I did wrong, please forgive me," which is a beautiful thing to do. And the fact that that person threw it back in her face with a vengeance might tell me more about that person.
What was it that was so intolerable? I wonder, too, how fragile was the friendship for somebody to say, I will never be your friend again? This couldn't have been a sturdy friendship. It couldn't have been. And if it was, then it was sturdy only until something happened that the person defined as a relationship-breaking event. Which, I guess I have to wonder, was it only a matter of time before Jamie would have done something else? Not gossip, but maybe something related to their relationship that the person couldn't accept and said, that's it, I'm out of here. I don't know. Speculation.
Call to Communion.
Through EWTN Radio, we talk to audiences all over the world. One thing I've found out is everybody in the whole world has the same set of questions. They live the same human life. They all want meaning. They all want love. They all want significance. They want forgiveness. That's the most fascinating thing to me. The same answers work wherever you are throughout the world because we're all children of God.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders. This afternoon, 2 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
The breadth of power that liberal governors such as Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan and Andrew Cuomo in New York seek to wield against private citizens during this current pandemic is frightening. Contrary to their views, our federal constitutional rights don't go away in an emergency. These governors feel only a nominal constraint by our Constitution, as evidenced by the restrictions they have imposed on our liberty. Under the banner of public health, they believe that their power is plenary and that the Constitution has little role, if any, in curtailing that power. They are mistaken. Indeed, there is no pandemic exception to the fundamental liberties guaranteed by the Constitution. If the courts, and more importantly, we the people who ultimately control the fate of these politicians at the ballot box, were to simply accept the governor's actions and acquiesce to their power grab, then it is the fiat of the governors and not the Constitution that is the supreme law of the land. We aren't willing to surrender our freedoms so easily. We filed multiple federal civil rights lawsuits against both governors in federal courts in Michigan and New York. In the final analysis, if we don't demand our God-given inalienable rights, then they will be lost. Fight for freedom or lose it. It's that simple. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
An email here. It said, I made the comment to a friend that if a candidate for office is pro-abortion, I could not vote for him. That's what our church would teach us. The response was, as you can imagine, you have to consider X, Y, and Z, too. What advice can you give me as a response? That's pretty simple. I believe, as the church teaches, that killing a baby is a pretty big issue. If you can say it's okay to kill a baby because you believe in a minimum wage, or you believe that there should be amnesty, or you believe that we should have public-supported health care, but killing a baby. Let me say that again. Killing a baby. I'm using that terminology more these days. Killing a baby. We've become so seared. I oftentimes say to people, if you think it's okay, if you would in fact support someone who says it's okay to kill a baby, even as it's being born, then I'm really not surprised at all by how you think of anything else. Okie dokie. Let's go to, keep it on this apology theme here. We have an anonymous caller, female from Pennsylvania. She counter to Jamie, who said, I went and apologized for something I think I did wrong. Our caller from Pennsylvania said, I didn't do anything wrong. But now that other person wants an apology.
You're being told you did something wrong. Did they tell you what it was?
Well, at one point, after a serious accident that permanently injured my own brother, his now former wife had her family members tell us that we had to apologize to her for wanting Jim to live when he didn't die.
Whoa. She wants you to apologize by going against the very deepest morals you believe in and apologizing because you didn't look at the situation in her wayward way.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, there was a feeding tube involved. There still is a feeding tube involved. It's been over 10 years. This person is still alive. No sign of any organ failure going on. And we are now caregivers. But at the time when everything was still raw, we were told by more than one of her family members that we were, you know, wrong. We wanted the person to live, therefore we were wrong. But we weren't doing anything.
But there's no apology required here. You didn't do anything wrong.
Well, but
that's like me saying, well, I didn't abort my kid. And look at my kid now, because he's 9 years old and he's in all kinds of trouble and perhaps he's got all kinds of developmental disabilities and I was wrong for not aborting him. That's nuts.
Right. So it's hard for me to come to the place where you're saying to forgive her. I mean, it's definitely an issue.
You have to recognize that she is, from your very deepest held moral perspective, based upon the existence of a God, a lawgiver, that she's quite wrong. Now, she may not recognize she's wrong because she doesn't follow, she doesn't believe in the things you believe in that you believe are true. Okay, it's not a matter of well, this is my opinion. I think that we should let him live, and her opinion is not. So we just disagree. Well, no.
Right.
If there's a God, then he's telling you what to do. So, given that, you recognize, you feel kind of bad for her, really, because she doesn't have any plumb line. She's just making the decision on the basis of what the culture says, what society says. What perhaps utilitarianism says. Hey, you know, he's been on a feeding tube for 10 years. Let's pull the plug. Come on. That's where she's at.
Yeah, and the hard part, Dr. Ray, is there are now young adult kids of between them that are quite estranged from under. They only seem to have her perspective.
And what would you expect?
Yeah.
What would you expect?
And their ability to come over here and hug their dad may never happen.
Well, then you throw in a few extra hugs yourself.
That's what we're doing.
Quit tormenting yourself because they have a wildly different perspective on this than you do. Be confident that you're doing what you believe is God-given instruction, and that's it. And that many of the people are not gonna, they're not gonna understand it. This is going to happen more and more as our culture rather rapidly dissolves the common moral glue that we shared more fully even a generation or two ago. Those who believe that God guides us in the ways to live are going to run afoul of the culture. And the culture is generally not tolerant. It won't say, well, okay, I can see how you'd think that, given what you believe. I think you're wrong. I don't think there really is a God guiding us. But if that's what you believe, I can sort of respect how you look at this. No. You do not get that tolerance. Not going to happen. You might say, well, I can understand how she thinks because she just has no traditional Christian beliefs.
So what do I expect? She's going to think like the culture tells her to think. She's going to embrace the cultural, I was going to say morals, but I don't know if you could call them that. So I think this is going to be something that Christians, we're dealing with more now, but we're going to have to deal with a lot more, which is we think a certain way, which at one time in this culture was more acceptable. Not everybody agreed with it, but enough did, or enough were more open-minded about it that allowed you to have that belief. Now, it's not a matter of, well, you can believe what you can believe. It's a matter of you're wrong, or worse, you're evil. And in our anonymous caller's case, you really owe an apology here for what you've done. Now, of course, the church teaching on this is that natural sustenance, which is food and water, is not to be denied to someone. Okay? You starve them to death, dehydrate them to death. That is not a quietly pleasant way to go. Not at all. But the culture says, come on. Come on. His life isn't that valuable. Besides, he's using resources. The sad thing of it is, as our caller pointed out, the children are paralleling their mother's beliefs. The children, at least at this point in their young lives, are thinking, I have no reason to go see him. I have no reason to go there. I have no reason to put my arm on his forearm and just say, hey, hi, Dad. No reason to do that. I can share with you something. I don't know what to make of this. My grandmother was in a nursing home the last years of her life. She was pretty confused, somewhat combative, and hostile. There was a young lady there who went into a coma giving birth. Non-responsive, completely non-responsive. The nurse's aides were talking to me about her. They said, We just sense that she's aware. She can't respond at all, but we sense she's aware. And one of them said to me that a doctor was in there talking about her state and how, in fact, in so many words, she's dead. And the nurse said, out of the corner of her eye, I saw the tears flow. One might say, well, okay, that it doesn't mean she sensed anything. It doesn't mean she heard anything. It doesn't mean this was an emotional response. It could just simply mean it was a natural kind of tearing up of the eye because it was dry and the eye was trying to compensate. Yeah, okay, that could be. Nonetheless, there were tears there. And that young mother may have been a lot more aware than we realized. And our caller's brother, perhaps, could be a lot more aware than people realize. Who knows? I'm Dr. Ray.
Dr. Ray has more great advice soon. Don't go anywhere.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Let us strive to know the Lord. Quick question to you and me right now. Is that what you and I are doing every single day? When you and I wake up every day, do we strive to know Jesus or not? In the Old Testament, in the same book of Hosea, a little bit later on, it's in chapter 14, the Lord says through the prophet, my people perish. Or in another translation, my people are being destroyed because of a lack of knowledge. Not a lack of data. We got tons of data, not a lack of information. We got a lot of information, not just about things that are happening in the world. We got a lot of data, a lot of knowledge, a lot of information about God. but not a lot of intimacy with God, not a lot of relationship with God, not a lot of friendship. That's the cry of God's heart. God wants to give himself to us in the incredible gift of friendship, and we're not taking advantage of it.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Not very good at making use of the final minutes of the clock. Kind of like NFL coaches that get critiqued. Poor use of the clock toward the end of the game. I seem to run into that a lot on Look Back Friday. So what I do, I go to my outlet pass. You know, I'm being rushed pretty hard. Got about 3.5 minutes left. I'm looking to the left, and I'm dumping the pass off to C.S. Lewis, Clive's Staples Lewis. This comes from his book, The Problem of Pain. Some say that death ought not to be final, that there ought to be a second chance. I believe that if a million chances were likely to do good, they would be given. But a master often knows, when boys and parents do not, that it is really useless to send a boy in for a certain examination again. Finality must come sometime. And it does not require a very robust faith to believe that omniscience knows when. You know, I used to wrestle with this. I used to think, okay, somebody died at age 31. They were a non-believer, perhaps an atheist, perhaps they just completely rejected God. What if they would have lived to 84? And in their 50s, they would have come back to the church, come back to faith. Seems like they got robbed of that chance now. That's my limited view. Like Lewis says, omniscience knows when it's likely that it's not going to happen. And in some respects, you don't want to think like this because death for us is so painful, but in some respects, it may be that people who die early in life are heaven-bound, whereas had they lived longer, they wouldn't have been. They would have rejected God. They would have become non-believers at every level. They would have become hostile toward God. You know people like that, who in their teenage years were very faith-filled, loving the Lord. One thing that I've seen for me is that God just doesn't do it the way we expect. Not at all. And so much of it is reverse of what the way we would think to do it in our human limitations. And I look at somebody who dies tragically young, and you don't want that, obviously. That's all we know. We don't want tragic death. But perhaps this is the hope. God says, I took them when they were most inclined toward me. I took them when they were most likely to spend infinity with me. I saw the future. You didn't. I saw where they would go. And I think that's kind of what Lewis is alluding to. He's saying, okay, but more chances. Give them another chance, give them another chance, give them another chance. And there comes a point where another chance is meaningless. Those of you who are parenting, those of you who have young adult children who just keep making mistake after mistake after mistake after mistake, and you keep trying to fix it. And every time you try to fix it, it doesn't work. It gets worse. Creates more problems. And you say to yourself, "I just one more chance, one more chance, one more chance." And at some point, you say, that's it. No more chances. Because those chances won't work. There's nothing more that I can do. This person has decided. Reed Lewis, he makes you ponder, doesn't he? So good to have you with me here on this Look Back Friday on The Doctor Is In. Thank you, Andrew Krucek, for your editing. And I thank all of you for your kind attention and your accompaniment here in this hour. Walk with God. Stay there. Don't get off the path.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.